night in the material that's been prepared, a lesson entitled Jesus Walks on Water. And we'll be starting with the text in John chapter 6, if you'd like to turn in your Bibles there to follow along with the reading in a minute. Again, we're glad to see everybody. If you're visiting with us, we're happy that you can be part of our study tonight. You ever heard somebody say, well, this sports player, this athlete, this business person, this whoever it is just so wonderful, it's like they walk on water. You ever heard that? Of course, that comes from the very miracle that we'll be talking about tonight. And while it might even border on being a little bit profane to say that about somebody when you take thinking about a miracle of Christ, it is something that humans realize, men realize, is supernatural. Men can't walk on water, you know, not normally. And to do that, you must be beyond human. You must be someone or something else beyond just a man to be able to do that. And so Jesus demonstrates to us His deity by this very event, the very thing that, you know, people who don't even know anything about the Bible say, well, they walk on, well, they just mean that they're extra special and that they're capable of what is beyond normal human accomplishment. And so tonight, as we look at, think about Jesus walking on water, just saying that, which it's a miracle that we've become very accustomed to, but just saying, well, Jesus walks on water, we're saying really that He is above the normal human. The Sea of Galilee, on which this occurs, as we've talked about several times already, several miracles of Jesus occur either on or around the lake. It's actually a freshwater lake with a length of 13 miles from north to south. It's about 8 miles wide, 686 feet below sea level, and it's surrounded by large cliffs which cause these strong wind currents. We've mentioned this a couple of times in looking at various miracles. Look at John 6 as you imagine the Sea of Galilee. Jesus has just fed the 5,000, and some of those who saw this miracle in John chapter 6 and verse 14 concluded, this is truly the prophet who has come into the world. Verse 15 says, therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again into the mountain by himself alone. Now, when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was already dark. Jesus had not yet come to them. Then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat, and they were afraid. But he said to them, it is I, do not be afraid. Then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going. This miracle is recorded in Matthew, Mark, and John, and each one of the accounts gives us some additional special information. I start with John's account because it gives us a little bit more as far as the background is concerned. We're going to notice Matthew's account is the one that includes Peter's request to walk on the water to Jesus, and we'll go and read that in a little while when we get a little closer to that. But you'll note on the Sea of Galilee, even on a calm day under a clear sky, the waves could be fairly high, the wind could be fairly boisterous, and I think that comes into this story a little bit as well, as we'll see later on in Peter walking or trying to walk on the water. But the background to the miracle is that Jesus again had just fed the 5,000. And in response to what he had done, not only in John's account do they declare him to be the prophet, but they would have made him king. If you look at verse 15. Now, I think that's a pretty interesting and noteworthy thing. They saw, the multitudes did, what a tremendous miracle this was, the feeding of the 5,000. They were ready to acknowledge him as their king. They were ready to take him to not only admit that he's Christ, but to inaugurate him as king right here and now. I gave you a quote in your lesson, and this is a little tangential to the discussion tonight, but I did want to make this point because I think it's an important thing to know in relation to you know, the denominational world that we live in and doctrine that we have to face day by day as we talk to our friends and neighbors. Premillennialists say that the kingdom didn't come, you know, that the kingdom is still to come, that Christ came to set up His kingdom on earth, but what happened, they say? What do the premillennialists say happened? He wasn't able to do it because the Jews rejected Him. Exactly. So, I have a quote in your lesson from John Walvoord, who's one of the leading, he's passed on now, but he's one of the leading premillennialists in the world. He says, there's much positive evidence in the New Testament for premillennial teachings. That's what he says. He says, it is clear that the Jews rejected Jesus as their King and Messiah. As you read this passage in John chapter 6 and verse 15, is that clear to you? Because it's not clear to me. It's not clear to me that they rejected Him as their King and Messiah. It looks like to me they're trying to make Him their King. They've already accepted Him as the Messiah over and over and over again. What's the little phrase that Jesus is referred to? The blind men called Him this. The Syrophoenicians going to call all these people that we've studied call Him what? The Son of David, which is an acknowledgement that they recognize Him as the Messiah, the Son of David, the King to come. And then you have people actually saying, you are the King now. We want to have you as King now. In John chapter 1, when Nathanael comes to Christ, you remember, Nathanael was not too keen on the idea that anything good could come out of Nazareth. And once Jesus talks to him for just a very short period of time, all of a sudden he says, You are the King of Israel. You are the King of Israel. And so he goes from complete unbelief to complete belief in just a very short matter of time, but he acknowledges Him as the King. And then at the end of Christ's life on earth, as He is standing before Pilate, Pilate asks Him the question in John 18, are You a King then? And Jesus' response to that is, you say rightly that I am a King. So Jesus Himself acknowledges that He is King. He had just been a few days prior to that, in what we call sometimes call the triumphal entry, but I think it would be better called the coronation entry, where Christ comes in and is lauded as the King as He enters Jerusalem. So my point to all of this is, this is a great passage to kind of put a star by in your Bible and remember when you're talking to a premillennialist. There are three or four passages like this in the New Testament that really show that in fact, far from rejecting Christ as being King, the Jews would, many of the Jews would gladly have made Him their King. And so it's an important passage to remember. Are there thoughts about that? Anybody else want to make a comment about that particular point? All right, think about with me. Jesus, rather than being taken to be made King, He sends the multitudes away. He sent the disciples into across the sea in a boat. I might make mention of this just briefly, and I know I'm bouncing around here a little bit, but we're trying to get everything kind of lined up so we can make some observations about the miracle. But in Mark's account, it seems like it's being said that He sent the disciples across the sea to Bethsaida. John's account plainly says that they rowed toward Capernaum. And a more careful reading of Mark's account, he may be indicating that they were near Bethsaida and they were being sent from there to Capernaum. That's more likely when you put the accounts together and look at the original language and several other things. In any case, He sends the disciples across the sea. They're going to go toward Capernaum on the water. He Himself goes where? Where does Jesus go? He goes up to a mountain to do what? To pray. Is this something that's unique to this occasion, or it is not, is it? In fact, we find as you go through the life of Christ many, many times, and sometimes just mentioned in brief or in passing, we'll find Jesus praying. I think there's a great lesson in that for us. It's a small observation, but there's a great lesson in that for us. If He who was the Son of God and had this eternal connection to His Heavenly Father, felt it important to pray. Surely we can see that it should be important to us as well. Christ was God on earth, all-powerful, but this connection with his Father, it was vital that he maintained that, and he talked to his Father often, and with a lot of fervency, obviously, on a number of occasions. In Luke chapter 6 and verse 12, before choosing the 12 apostles, he went out to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. All night. In Luke chapter 9 and verse 18, you read about on occasion it happened as he was praying alone. So again, he's praying alone. In Luke chapter 11 and verse 1, I think there was a reference in your lesson to Luke 11:11, but it's 11 and verse 1 of Luke. It says that it came to pass as he was praying in a certain place, and one of his disciples said to him, "Lord, teach us to pray." And so he takes that occasion to teach them about prayer. But Jesus is a man who's devoted to prayer. And in this, he sets a wonderful example for us. If he was devoted to prayer, we also ought to be. And we'll come back and make some observations about that later. Well, so here's the setting. He's alone by himself up on the mountain. He's in prayer. He goes apparently for long hours now, way into the night, praying. The disciples are out on the sea, rowing toward Capernaum. The multitude has gone away, probably, in fact, to the town of Bethsaida, which was near to where the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 occurred. The disciples are rowing, and what kind of progress are they making? And this is important to the miracle. How are they doing? Are they doing pretty well? Yeah, one text says they're in the midst of the sea, and John says they rode 3 or 4 miles toward Capernaum, which is about as far, you know, they should have been very close to Capernaum. That's about as, you know, as far as it would be at the most. So, yeah. Now, if you've ever been in a boat on the water, again, you know, that's against the wind, it's amazing how much force that can put on the boat. And even if you're rowing, especially, or maybe even you have a trolling motor, if you've got you guys that bass fish, you get out with a trolling motor, if it's not very strong, that wind can still push you in the opposite direction of where you think you're going. And that something like that may even have been happening here. But they're straining, one of the texts says, they're straining at the rowing. The wind was heavy against them, and we'll see in a little bit that the waves are also up and boisterous. And so you get this view of this. It's way late in the night. The apostles, the disciples are giving it all they've got at rowing. They've gone a good long way, but they seem not to be able to get to their destination. And it's at this time then that Jesus comes down off the mountain, his time in prayer finished, and in the fourth watch of the night. What time of night is that? You divide the night up into, say there's 12 hours and there's 4 watches, and the fourth watch is the last watch. 3 hours apiece. So you basically 3 to 6 a.m. is the time that you're talking about. The very dead hours of the night, you know, most everybody's asleep then. That's when Jesus comes walking to them on the sea. A fascinating account in Mark chapter 6 and verse 48. In fact, let's go to Mark 6 and let me read a few verses out of Mark's account of this. Mark chapter 6. Again, he saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. At the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea, and would have passed them by. Mark is the only record that has that phrase in it. I get a picture in my mind of these men just, you know, again, giving it all they've got at the oars, just straining at the rowing, as the text says. And Jesus is walking on the water and is making such progress, in fact, that he could easily have just walked by them as if, you know, he's going forward and they're going backwards. And it was nothing. He would have passed them by. You know, it's like you know, you're going on the interstate and you're having trouble with your car and you're only going, you know, 35 or 40 miles an hour and somebody goes by you going 100. And it's, you know, just, it's that kind of a, of a picture I get. Are there any implications in that? Is it too much to make a conclusion or learn a lesson from that about the relative, the difference, if you will, between the ability of Christ and the very best efforts of man? Do you see something that should be learned from that? That what Christ does apparently easily and incredibly and amazingly, walking on water, which you're not supposed to do that anyway, and he's making way more progress than 12 guys in a boat with oars. It's really amazing to me, that little comparison. And again, we may go back toward the end of the lesson and make some observations about that. From the geography of it, well, it should be against it. If they're rowing against it, and he's going in the same direction they are. I think so. I mean, is there? I can't imagine any other way. Right. Right. Where he could walk in just a very short time. Yeah. So. Yeah, my understanding of what the text is telling us is that the wind is so far against them that they're not making any progress and may even be losing ground, whereas he, when he starts to walk, just sort of passes them by. Maybe I'm not seeing something, or I am seeing something that's not there. But anyway, that's the visual that I get in my head as I read the text and try to put them together. When they see him, what do they think? It's a ghost. What would you think? If you've ever been on the water at night, it's an eerie thing anyway, and you see somebody, maybe in the moonlight or starlight or something, walking, first of all, you're not supposed to be on the water. You're not supposed to be on the water. So anytime you'd see somebody on the water, you would think, well, this can't be real. This is a ghost. It's something supernatural is going on here. So yeah, you would think that. And then again, this sort of eerie time of night, I think, would compound that. And they are afraid. All of the texts note their fear. Let's go now and read Matthew's account of it. Not the whole thing, but at least this last part. Starting in verse 26 of Matthew 14. Matthew 14:26. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." They think it's a ghost. Jesus tries to calm their fears. He doesn't want them being afraid. He wants them to recognize who he is. All of that. He tells them to be of good cheer. "It is I. Do not be afraid." Peter says to him, "Lord," what? "If it is you." Let's start with that. "If it is you." Does he sound very convinced? Not totally convinced, is he? And right there, I think, begins Peter's problem. I know I preached a lesson on this not too long ago. But when you start, you're addressed to the Lord, when your Lord tells you something, and then you come back with Well, if that's the case, you know, that shows a lack of faith to begin with. So Peter's not in a good position. And then he says, Lord, if it is you, and you finish that sentence, command me to come to you on the water. And I think this is a point maybe that we made in the lesson a few weeks ago, but it's never a good thing to tell God what to command you to do. You see the presumption there? It's just, Lord, here's what I want you to tell me to do this. It's sort of, He's the Lord. He'll tell you what He wants you to do. And I think we see all at once Peter's immediately a glimmer of lack of faith, and then of his presumption and pride to sort of put himself in a position where he's telling the Lord what to tell him. And Peter does this more than once. I think, you know, before he might finally learn his lesson. And in it, there's a lesson for us. I believe Peter's failure here is one that contains a number of lessons for us. But he says, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. So Jesus says, come. Jesus commands him to do exactly what he wanted to do. What about Peter's pride in putting himself forward to do this? As we've already said, walking on the water is a supernatural feat. We can't fully get into Peter's head, but knowing what we know and looking at these circumstances, why do we think? Why does he really want to walk on the water? Is it to prove that Jesus is Jesus? Well, he could do that when Jesus got in the boat, couldn't he? What's Peter really wanting to do here? I'd like to try that too. Yeah. So I think that's, you know, again, him being a man, that sounds like something probably most of the men here would do. I want to try that too. And maybe, as we said, it's universally acknowledged that this is a supernatural, feat. And to think, well, hey, I could do this. And then, hey, you know, hey, Mom, look at me, no hands. It's like putting himself in this position where everybody from then on, had Peter succeeded, I could just see all the apostles sitting around the fire later on. Yeah, that's Peter, boy, he's great. He scored all the points in the big game, and plus he walked on the water. You know, it's just all of that sort of male pride, I think, that is compounding all of this. So, again, we can't fully get into his head, but it seems like that's the direction all of that's going. He tries, and at first he finds some success. It says he walked on the water to go to Jesus, and that must have been an amazing step or two, at least, that he took. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. We've said this before about Peter. Peter was used to the ocean. He was used to the sea. He spent a lot of time on it. He could swim. In the last chapter of the Gospel of John, he swims about 100 yards from a boat to the shore with a coat on. But here again, it's a storm, or at least strong winds. The sea is boisterous. He has doubts, and he has fears. And a lot of people looked at this and said, well, he took his eyes off Jesus, which, you know, that's always a mistake when you've got troubles in your life to take your eyes off Jesus. He's looking at the wind. He's looking at his circumstances instead of staying focused on Christ, who is all-powerful, who is walking on the water. And again, there may be some lessons, things to be observed there. I don't know. But in any case, he is afraid. And he begins to sink, and he cries out saying, Lord, save me. And the text says that immediately Jesus stretched out his hand. I would have been tempted, perhaps, and this is, you know, me. I'm glad that the Lord is a lot better than I am, because I would have been tempted to let Peter thrash around for a while and maybe even hold his head under the water for a little bit or something like that. But the Lord is merciful. And the Lord is kind and caring. And the Lord doesn't do that. Immediately, as soon as Peter calls out to him, the text says, the Lord stretches out his hand and reaches down and grabs him, catches him and says, O ye of little faith, why did you doubt? Peter's faith was little. It was little from the beginning of this experiment, and he needed to have that pointed out to him. A number of times, Jesus will ask his disciples questions like this. And most of the time, if you read through the Gospels, when things like this happen, he doesn't take the time or there's no answer. A few times does it say, well, what the disciples went away and thought, or what Jesus said after that. It's just, he's trying to get them to examine their lack of faith and understand, first of all, that they have it, and secondly, or that they don't have faith, and secondly, that it needs to be increased and it can be increased. And I think that we in our lives, if Jesus were speaking to us, you know, out of the night somewhere and were saying words to us directly, I wonder how many times he would say that to us, O you of little faith, when it's never his power that's the problem. Do we understand that in our lives? It's never his lack of ability that's the problem. It's always our lack of faith. And we turn to Jesus and we turn to the Lord and we say, well, why aren't you helping me here? Or why are you doing this? Or what about that? And here I am floundering along and not making it in life. And it's not him, it's us. Jesus always turns at his disciples. Think about your faith. Think about, are you trusting me? Are you focused on me? Do you trust my power? Or are you so caught up in your circumstances that you're not really looking to me? I just think it's a great lesson. And so, this is an interesting picture, a reenactment actually on the Sea of Galilee. I don't know how they got that guy on the water, but I'm sure he wasn't actually walking on it. But why did you doubt, O you of little faith? And that's the question. Well, in response to this miracle, Jesus then gets in the boat. Peter then gets in the boat. And the texts tell us that those who were in the boat were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure. And they marveled. Mark chapter 6 tells us. Verse 52 adds to that they had not understood about the loaves because their heart was hardened. It seems that while the multitudes had a pretty firm appreciation of what Jesus did in feeding the loaves to the 5,000, the apostles still weren't getting all of the message there. And this miracle was added in less than 24 hours, in about 12 hours. This miracle was added on the top of the feeding of the 5,000 for the special benefit of the disciples, so that they might have this point driven home in their minds, which they definitely needed to get, about who Jesus was. They had not understood about the loaves, Mark tells us in Mark 6. So, the text in Matthew 14 says that they came and worshipped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. Now they acknowledge what should have been firmly grasped, certainly earlier that day, and actually way, way before this, with the many miracles that Jesus has already performed. As we said to begin with, walking on water, that's something else. And Jesus demonstrates himself to be the Son of God by that great feat on this occasion. And we want to talk about some things that we've mentioned a little bit earlier, maybe explore them a little more deeply as far as lessons that we can take away from this. I mentioned already about premillennialism, misunderstanding the nature of the kingdom. Let's go back and talk about that for a minute, as long as we have a few minutes. Why is it, for those who maybe have done some studying of premillennialism and maybe some who've talked to friends and neighbors about the issue, why is it that they can't, in their system of thinking, they can't allow for Jesus to have set up the kingdom when he came to earth? Why can't they allow for that? Yeah, they can't have it. They can't have the kingdom set up already, because if they did, he's not going to come back, and there's not going to be the thousand-year reign of Christ on earth. And so they have to, because their concept is of an earthly kingdom, and they don't see an earthly kingdom, they can't. You know, Jesus didn't set up an earthly kingdom when he was here, but Jesus told Pilate about his kingdom, about its nature. He said, you say rightly that I am a king. And he said, my kingdom is what? Not of this world. And that's really the point that the premillennialists don't get. And so it seems to me there's a lesson here. And it's not just about that false doctrine, but a lot of false doctrines and sometimes a lot of false beliefs that we ourselves have. One error or one false concept, and in this case, it's that the kingdom is earthly. Once you start with that, then you've got to invent lots of other things to cover that and explain it. And each of those is a compounding error. I was thinking about, maybe talk to Pat about this a little bit later. I heard him discuss with a man who was a believer in keeping the Sabbath day a couple of weeks ago. And it seems to me that the people who believe in keeping the Sabbath day, That problem, that false idea, really stems from about six other false ideas. And one that goes maybe all the way back to understanding the authority of the apostles. It seemed to me in the discussion that they didn't really appreciate the fact that the apostles, in writing what they wrote in the New Testament, saying what they said, had the authority of Jesus Christ. But so you make a conceptual mistake, and then everything else goes haywire as a result. And I think that's an important lesson. Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. Well, Mike's saying, and I hope everybody was able to hear that, but basically that with the power that Christ had shown in feeding thousands and healing people, first of all, let's back up even from what he said. What's the number one issue in our political climate right now? People are all concerned about the economy, right? If somebody could give us all free food and fix health care, what would we do? We'd vote for him, right? Give us all free food and fix health care. So right now you've got, if Jesus is doing that already, and then think about the army that he could support to throw off Roman oppression. That's what Mike was talking about as well, and healing the soldiers on the battlefield and all that sort of thing. Well, yeah, that's who you want to be king. Free food and health care and plus an undefeatable army. That's who you'd want to be king. So you can understand why, in fact, that is what they wanted. It's exactly, and getting back to the premillennial thought, it's so clear that they would have been thrilled to make him an earthly king. And if that's what he'd come to do, and that's what he wanted to be, he could have done that in a second. they'd have been thrilled to do that. But that wasn't his purpose. So both they and our premillennial friends missed that very, very important point. Jesus prayed without ceasing. That's another point that we made so many times in his life. We find him in prayer. And that's what he asked us to do as well, to pray without ceasing. It should be the case that in our lives, prayer is a constant. And we are ever in communication with God. Colossians 4:2 talks about continuing earnestly in prayer and being vigilant in it with thanksgiving. And 1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray without ceasing. We talked a little bit as well about his very impressive feet in walking on the water, passing by his disciples as they strained, unable to get anywhere. And by that, Jesus shows us how much greater his divine power is than our feeble human efforts. And then also, Peter was not only rescued from the water. And let me maybe just make this observation. When we learn these miracles as children, not just the miracles, but most all of the Bible stories, when we learn them as children, we learn the facts. And the facts are amazing in and of themselves. But the lesson in many, many Bible events, miracles, Old Testament stories, the lesson goes deeper than the facts. There are obvious conclusions that we would make as adults and see clearly that a child, because they're not critical thinkers yet, isn't going to see. And sometimes we get this attitude as adults, well, we know all those Old Testament stories. We know all about the miracles of Jesus. We know, you know, and so we don't have to go back and look at those things very deeply. And I hope that one of the things that we're getting out of this study is that when you actually do go back and look at these miracles that we think we know all about, in fact, we see all sorts of things that we didn't see before, that weren't clear to us in our childhood when we learned about the miracle. And that's the value of this. And never think that you can't learn something more about something that you think you already know everything about. Because, in fact, I think we can. Mike, do you have a thought? Right. Yeah. Again, what he's saying there is that, rather than being when Jesus commands Peter to come, an irresistible grace where he's going to do it now, you know, and there's no chance of failure, it's entirely the opposite of that. Christ commands him to come, allows him to do so. But it has to do with Peter's faith and his ability to work according to his faith. And you see that all through the New Testament. And so there are a lot of tenets of false doctrines, whether you're talking about Calvinism or premillennialism, that if you'll just observe things in these miracles, you see some of the problems with them. As we conclude tonight, let me share something with you that John C. Ryle wrote that I thought was really helpful in drawing some of the lessons that we can get out of this. He said, "With the Lord Jesus Christ, nothing is impossible. No stormy passions are so strong, He can tame them. No temper is so rough and violent, He can change it. No conscience is so disturbed, He can speak peace to it and make it calm. No person ever need despair if they will only bow down their pride and come as a humble sinner to Christ. Christ will carry them through every danger. Christ will make them conqueror over every foe. What if our relatives oppose us? What if our neighbors laugh at us to scorn? What if our place be hard? What if our temptations be great? It is all nothing if Christ is on our side, and we are in the ship with Him. For greater is He that is in us, is for us, than all those who are against us." think that's a great lesson and something we can observe from this miracle. Well, appreciate everybody's help tonight.